Welcome back or welcome to the Single Track Podcast. I'm your host, Finn Melanson, and in this episode, we're joined by Christian Meyer, a professional trail runner for Salomon and business owner based in Girona, Spain. We talk about the differences in professional cultures of cycling and ultra trail running, his interest in the Norwegian style of endurance training, reaching multiple performance peaks throughout his career, and his work in the sports apparel and brick and mortar spaces outside of his own athletic pursuits. Before we get started, though, thanks to NAC for supporting this episode. I'm getting ready for a local race called the Antelope Island 50-miler as a part of my build for the Cocodona 250 later this spring, and on almost every run, I have been turning to NAC's Ultra Energy watermelon-flavored drink mix for multiple reasons. It's fast-acting, it's easy to ingest, and it provides all the nutrients you need to race an ultra, and that's what I like in particular is that it's got these complete proteins and BCAAs at optimized levels to help stave off muscle fiber degradation during these longer efforts. And yeah, it's worked for me over the past few months at races like the Red Mountain 50K. And if you want to try some for yourself, head over to NAAK.com, that's spelled N-A-A-K.com, and use code SINGLETRACK15 at checkout for 15% off your next order. With that, let's get to the conversation with Christian Meyer. Christian Meyer, it is a pleasure to have you on the Single Track Podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, thank you. Pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you here. I was preparing for this episode, I was kind of going through some of the archives of conversations you've done on previous shows, and there was one particular quote that stuck out to me. You said, compared to cycling, it's funny how unprofessional ultra running is. And I'm well aware that, you know, over in the cycling world, it's all about marginal gains, and you're a relative newcomer to the ultra running space. And I guess from that quote, it kind of shocked you about what the minimum requirements were to be successful in our sport. So talk more about that experience and like what the level of preparation is over in the cycling world versus here at the pro level.
Yeah. I mean, it is really interesting. I mean, from many aspects, also from, you know, we're starting to see these changes happening now, I think, slowly. I mean, just in terms of team structures. I mean, I started running a few years ago, and when I first came in, you really had this sense of it's less about teams as more it is about athletes running for a brand, you know, but that actual team structure behind it is so much more basic or non-existent. I mean, like I said, I think some teams now are definitely doing that. It's happening now, but it's very new in the last year or two, I would say, in running. Okay. But like when you think about cycling, I mean, cycling is a sport that's been around for a long time. It's definitely a sport in the last, you know, when I was an athlete, and even more so than in these last 5 years, 6 years since, it has really become about marginal gains. You know, the differences in the athletes are so small in terms of preparation and level of fitness that we had to search for everything we could in every aspect. If that was nutrition, you know, it's about you know, aero jerseys, aero helmets versus regular helmets versus, you know, road race skin suit versus, you know, we're getting into, you know, at the level that we were at, like I could watch a race on TV and I could tell you which tires that a team was racing on because you could tell them the descending speeds and the things and like how they're able to, you know, the difference that a bike would make, you know, couple hundred grams heavier, couple hundred grams lighter. You know, these were all things that became like super important. You know, like the training is like became the thing that everybody was doing it to the best of their capabilities. You know, at that level, nobody was kind of like slacking or getting away with doing a little bit less training than another. Everybody's doing altitude camps. Everybody is doing the maximum of training. So then we start to look at equipment, we start to look at, you know, having a chef at all the races, you know, down to there's teams that are, they are literally coming in, they have a team that travels, you know, so this is generally more in the grand tours, in the 3-week tours. There's a team that travels to the hotels before the riders get there, and they change the mattresses. They come in, they vacuum, they take all the old mattresses out that are in there, they vacuum the rooms, get rid of all the dust, everything, put in the team issue mattresses with team issue linens, team issue pillows, the whole nine yards. The idea being that the guys can sleep on the same mattress every night. So you have a better night or a more consistent night's sleep. We all know sleeping is like one of the number one recovery tools. So you think like every night switching hotels, and sometimes, you know, people might see the Tour de France thing as this big glamorous thing, but plenty of times you're sleeping in pretty average, very basic hotels. And, you know, you can have a crappy mattress, or, you know, the room can be sort of old and you've got dust, and then you can have allergies. I mean, eliminating every possible variable imaginable to just develop consistency through the whole event. And I mean, those things, they sound pretty outrageous, but like, you know, that's kind of pretty standard now. And if you want to get the best out of each athlete, I mean, you have to control the variables to the maximum that you can. And that's just kind of, it's kind of standard practice.
One thing that I'm curious about, because I have to imagine at your level of cycling, what you were doing in those scenarios was what was required to fight for that last 1-2% of performance. And it makes me wonder, is when you pivoted into ultra trail running, were you excited to bring that level of preparation over to our sport? Or did you see, once you kind of surveyed our landscape and realized what was required for success, were you excited to maybe take your foot off the brake, or put your foot on the brake, I should say, and do things in like a more chill way? Like, talk about that.
Yeah, I think definitely both. I mean, when I started running, to be honest, I didn't see that I had this intention to necessarily go and you know, try to win UTMB or try to win TDS or have these types of successes. I entered the sport as like, this is just super cool. I love the challenge of it. And I love this idea of doing something completely unknown. You know, like, yeah, when I started running, it was terrible. Like, I was terrible at running. You know, I was injured all the time and like doing everything wrong. And like, it was fun and I just didn't care. And I would go and just run as hard as I could. And then I exploded in a race and then finished last. I didn't really care. You know, it was just about finding that new thing that excited me. And I just loved sport and that. And then I started, like, I go through these sorts of phases, and I really just got back into, like, I loved being an athlete when I was a cyclist. Like, I love, for some reason, to me, like, that lifestyle and getting up in the morning and training is just like, it just suits me. And that's just what I love to do. Like, I'm never not motivated to go out and train. Just because I love training, and the racing is somewhat secondary, but I just love going out and pushing myself and just trying to be the best I can be, more out of curiosity than in terms of trying to prove something. And then, so when I started running, and then it kind of became a bit more, and I really enjoyed, and I was able to get to that point where I felt like I could go and do, I could go and do the miles and I could do the work, then it became something a little different and a little more exciting towards the racing side. You know, because when I was a cyclist, I felt like I could go every day and ride and kind of do whatever I wanted. You know, like, you get to a point where you can accumulate a large volume of work, right? So if tomorrow's like, yeah, I'll go do a 6-hour ride, that's pretty normal, you know? And when I started running, there was these natural limitations, right? Just because I hadn't made the adaptation. So it took a long time. Like, it probably took me 2.5 years of running before I felt that kind of like, okay, now I can go and run. Like, tomorrow if I wanted to go to the mountains and run for 4 or 5 hours, I can kind of do that. And I'm not going to be buggered and I'm not going to, you know, injure myself and I'm not going to have these issues. Once I got to that point in running, I felt like, okay, now this is pretty cool. Like, let's get into a bit more and, you know, take the training, not more serious, but like I can dedicate all the training volume to running. And then I can start to think more about these little gains and little things and like, and the exciting part about how to manage a race in terms of where can we, like, first off, to me, it's like the number one marginal gain for me is where can we eliminate the lost time? Like time that you're literally giving away, which is like at aid stations, right? Like you see now, interestingly to see in the last, especially I would say probably the last two UTMBs, is like you could see people were in and out of like aid stations, right? And all of a sudden, you know, why is that? Well, okay, let's see about breaking 20. Okay, what's the first thing you're going to look at if you want to break 20 hours UTMB? How much of that time are you giving away for free? Like previous years, like if you looked at a UTMB, I don't know, 5, 6, 7, 10 years ago, I mean, they probably had like an hour of stoppage time. Probably, you know, like it wouldn't be uncommon to go into multiple aid stations, not just sort of Courmayeur and Champex, but like probably multiple ones where you like bleed out 5, 10 minutes pretty easily. And then, you know, you add that up through like 10, 15 aid stations, all of a sudden you're like, holy cow, I've lost an hour just free. Like literally, but you can like go into an aid station, grab your bottles and walk out, keep walking while you put them in, but like you're moving forward and you're gaining meters, you know? And so it's like, that's like such a simple thing before even getting, like, you know, in running, I think, or in ultras, we look at, you know, there's a lot of talk of marginal gains starting to happen. You know, people talk about marginal gains. Like, obviously, it's caught some attention because here we are talking about marginal gains. But we're pretty much still at maximal gains to be made in ultra running, I would say. You know, like, we've not dialed in yet to the marginal ones. We still have some pretty basic ones to tackle that are kind of low-hanging fruit, I think, that are available before even having to, like, get to the real marginal stuff, you know? So it is pretty interesting. But, yeah, to your question, I mean, I think I kind of like both aspects. It's pretty chill. And it's still relatively chill. I mean, even for some of the stuff that I kind of think about and I try to do or try to implement in races, you know, they're still relatively, you know, simple. We've not gotten into the real meat of it yet, but it's coming for sure. It's coming.
You know, you mentioned UTMB and it reminded me another one of the observations you made about our sport maybe a year or two ago was there weren't a lot of tactics that were happening between runners. Like you observed somebody, and again, this, you know, take up Killian or a Walmsley or whoever, Zach Miller, there wasn't a lot of cunning about how they were going to win a particular race, at least from your observation. So go into more detail about that and compare that to cycling.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting in the ultra one. I think like in 2 years ago, I think Killian and Jim were playing each other a little bit, you know, like taking some digs, and, you know, Jim would try to kind of run the downhills a bit quicker, and you know, Killian tried to attack on Grand Col Ferret a bit, put the pressure on. Like there was a little bit there, but for the most part, it's one of these sports that you kind of like, an ultra is quite special because you do need to kind of run your race. Like you can't, it's harder in an ultra to overextend yourself, recover, overextend yourself, like do attacks and pushes without in the long run kind of burning your candles. But where I find it more interesting is like, more in sort of the golden trail distance. Like I feel in the golden trail distance, like that 2 to 3 hours of racing, there could be more team tactics involved, you know, like, now those races seem a little bit like, okay, you kind of run as hard as you can and you give a nudge and then you like, you try to, yeah, but like still quite individual. But I wonder if in gold in that shorter distance, you could have a bit of teamwork happening. You know, one guy kind of attacking off the front or, and, you know, his teammate kind of letting other people chase, like things like that, I think could be quite cool to see happen a bit more in the shorter distance for sure. I think that would be, well, I think it'd be quite exciting. Cause also you would build a little bit more of that team dynamic, wouldn't you? You'd be a bit more like, you could speak a bit about the teams more so a little bit in the commentary versus maybe just like the athletes themselves, you know, and how they can play off each other a little bit more and stuff. But yeah, I'd love to see a bit more team tactic action.
So you think maybe in the case of ultras, like a race like UTMB, where, you know, at least on the men's side, it's a 20-hour race, women's side, 23 to 25 hours, because it's so long, because, you know, from like a musculoskeletal standpoint, it's so damaging. It's risky to play a tactical game in terms of like making moves back and forth on your competitors.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's sort of, I mean, there is definitely tactics that you can employ in that race, which I'm not going to go too much into because, you know, maybe one day I want to deploy those tactics. But no, there's a lot that you could do as a team, I think, definitely. I mean, but it's like, I think they would be very advanced tactics. And the difficult part is you also, I mean, as a team, team sports are not individualistic, right? Team sports are team sports. So right now, I mean, I think it's quite difficult to, like when I was a cyclist, I worked for somebody and that was my role. And right now, I mean, cycling is still running is at a point where, you know, athletes are athletes, you know, they're on the team because everybody wants the shot to give their best day at UTMB. Right. And that is kind of what they are paid for and hired for. And that is what they're there to do. Right. If you want to deploy team tactics, you're probably at some point going to have to, have some runners who are willing to sacrifice their race for somebody else. Right. And we're not really at that stage yet, I think, you know, and also that sort of comes with when the sport, I think, has a bit more depth, you know, and, you know, I think those types of things are when you start to pull into marginal gains, you know, like that's when, you know, the individuals have maximized or the teams have maximized and they're like, okay, how can we get a little bit more out of the team and out of the runners, and we start to have certain roles for certain runners or things like that. But I think, you know, I think now we're talking, you know, we still got a lot to do before we get to that point.
You know, we're talking team now. One of the first things that came to mind for you at the top of the conversation was team structure in terms of the differences between cycling and running. And this is less a question, more of a comment, but it's, you know, and it's a theme that we've explored a lot on this show, but sort of the most sophisticated version of a team in ultra running in 2024, it involves a group chat, maybe one to two co-located training camps a year, and maybe crewing / pacing for each other at a couple races. But like in the cycling world, I mean, you are spending what, like 180 to 220 days a year with your teammates, like just vastly different.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, quite a lot of difference. I mean, like, I think at the end of the day, you know, in cycling, you have a meeting at the beginning of the year, your first training camp, you know, your schedule is laid out for you. I mean, you do have some input in the races that maybe you would like to do, but essentially it's the team that decides what races you're doing, right? At the end of the day, in a cycling team, you are paid to do a job, right? So, you are not dictating all the things you would like to do, you know? Yeah. So there's races that you do that you don't want to do. Maybe they're not maybe your favorite ones, but you go and you do the job and you sort of do that. And also there's a lot around the team dynamic, because obviously you're racing together as a team for one guy on the team wins, but there's, you know, 7 or 8 other guys there to help that happen. Right. So team cohesiveness, learning to work together, being comfortable to work together, understanding each other, like the level of understanding that goes into being, for example, a good domestique, who, you know, a rider who only works for others, which is what I did most of my career. Like, you really get to know your leader. So, you know, you understand their little mannerisms. Like, you understand what they look like when they're pedaling a little bit tired. You know what they look like when they're feeling good. You know how they want to move up in the bunch. You know, some people like to go up the outside. Some people like to, you know, use less energy and work through the inside. They're comfortable maneuvering through the bunch when it's really tight. You understand all those little minute things about how they operate, because your job at the end of the day is to make their life as easy as possible, right? So all that comes from spending a lot of time together and riding together and training together and racing together. You develop a really deep understanding of your teammates and the people around you and how they function. So one, it's very important. And then secondly, you know, every cycling is a very organized calendar, right? So it's very simple. There is essentially the world tour. All the teams go to all the races. So there's not kind of like, oh, you know, we'll do this race over here, that one over there, this one's exciting, or a new race. You know, everybody races the same races. So there's a lot of racing to do. And the team's always together, obviously. So it's quite different. I think I do see some teams that I think are doing a pretty good job at it, from what I see from the outside. You know, starting to see teams that have, you know, a chalet in the summer where all runners can go to and train from, down to having, you know, more support around them, and encouraging that team's structure a little bit more.
Yeah.
But I mean, the other thing though, that's difficult, that running, trail running still is lacking. When I was a cyclist, I was also a cyclist. That is the only thing I did. Right. So it didn't matter when the training camp was, you know, I didn't need time off from work. I didn't need to organize my schedule. My job was just being there. So, I mean, I was a cyclist 365 days a year. And, you know, in running, we're still at that point where, you know, a majority of professional runners still are working somehow in another capacity, right? So, you know, organizing more than 2 training camps a year can be quite difficult if they have to deal with, you know, either family or, you know, some other sort of work commitment or something. I think it's not until the athlete can be 100% dedicated to the sport, it is difficult to demand the amount of time it takes to have that kind of organization. You know what I mean? So it's kind of comes with the other, right? When salaries get higher, people can dedicate more time. Team budgets need to increase because those training camps are also expensive. Each time you put one of those on, like the budget, the global budget, I think still needs to increase quite significantly to be able to have that approach where it's like, we are a full on team, you know, and we expect people to be at training camps and we expect people to be at these races. You need to pay for that, to be honest.
Also, thanks to Rabbit, the official apparel partner of Singletrack. If you're listening to this in mid-March, spring is basically here, and like me, you're probably switching out your running wardrobe as temperatures get warmer. Two pieces of gear that I've been turning to, the first is Rabbit's Speedster X Running Tight. It's super lightweight, it's quick drying, it's made with materials that fight bacteria and eliminate odor, super comfortable, and maybe my favorite component, it's got these two side stash pockets that fit my phone and nutrition with minimal to no bounce. The other is Rabbit's Switchback Tee, which I love for many reasons, including the awesome colorways. It's also got this semi-relaxed fit for cling-free performance. And anyways, for listeners of the podcast, we've got a great discount for you. Feel free to use code SINGLETRACK20 at checkout for 20% off your next order on their website. And with that, let's get back to the conversation with Christian Meyer. One thing I've been thinking a lot about recently is how rapidly the level of preparation for a given race is increasing and improving year over year. And maybe for you, you'll have to get beta on consecutive years at UTMB or a race that you end up doing, you know, multiple years in a row. But I've started to ask a lot of athletes the question of, you know, take your, for example, your 2023 self at a race like UTMB, compare that to your 2024 self at a UTMB, and then survey or compare yourself to the field in each of those years. And how much more prepared did you have to be year over year to either produce an identical result, or how much did you have to improve just to stay at your baseline from the previous year? Like, that's a question that I don't know if you think about that a lot, like how much different do you have to be from your previous self to still be successful and relevant in the sport? But I get the sense that it's changing quite a bit.
Yeah. I mean, I think you can see it. I mean, if you were to look at, I think last year's UTMB, and you look at that top 10, top 12, you're kind of like, holy cow. Yeah. Like, these guys are all, you know, they're all winning other races, right? And, you know, like you take guys like Hannes and you know, Shumi and like all these kind of guys, you're like, wow, that's such a stacked top 10. Whereas it feels like not that long ago, it used to be a stacked top 6 or top 7. And then you look back a few years and it was a stacked top 5, you know, and it's like the further back you go, it's like, obviously the depth is getting higher and getting deeper every year. And I think we're going to see that it's going to take more and more to get to the front. And I think also it's going to be more and more, like it used to kind of feel like, oh yeah, podium at UTMB. But now I feel like even for a lot of brands, having someone in the top 10 is going to be a significant result at UTMB. You know, like it's not just going to be like, oh, we're on the podium. It's like, because it's going to get more and more expensive to have the runners in the top 10. And then, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I'll need probably a couple more years and I'll have to try a UTMB and see. But on the other hand, I think sometimes it's really crazy to see or cool to see some of the athletes that have essentially evolved with the sport. And I think I look at someone like Zach, and he's such a prime example of that. Like when I started running, I loved that the Billy Yang film when they went to all the Nike guys went to UTMB.
Classic. Right?
Classic film. And like you look at that, that was like ages ago. And they were like in the front, and like, you know, Zach was just out there just like slaying it, you know? And then you look like last year, I mean, that was what, 2015, I think, when they went over.
10 years ago.
Yeah. And you're like, holy cow, he's still running at the front. You know, speeds have increased, races have gotten faster, but he's a guy that kind of maintained and continued to grow and develop and still be running in the front. And I think that's like super impressive to see those guys, because there's I feel kind of a handful that can kind of do that as the sport progresses to continue to build, you know, the speed and endurance to maintain that sort of front runner position. So, yeah, hats off to him. I mean, he's crushing it.
2015 is a good one. The race that I always reference for UTMB is 2017. And a lot of the names that were inside the top 10 that year are still relevant and they've improved upon their former selves. So people like Jim Walmsley, yeah. Francois Dane, Killian, Xavier, Tim Tollefson, David Lane. Like it's just, it is, like you said, it's amazing that in a sport where a lot of athletes are either hanging by a thread or they have this very quick, but then brief stay at the top, yeah. there is some evidence of staying power too. Like, I feel like yeah. that's another indicator of an increasingly professionalized sport where the people that do get to the top, they have the ability to maintain that high performance baseline for a longer period of time.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So we're catching you at the beginning of your Substack era. I wish that, you know, we kind of caught you when you were like five or six posts deep so we could talk more about those topics. But one of the things I saw you hinting at was that you are an appreciator of the Norwegian style of training, and you did some like double thresholds are a hot topic. You incorporated some of that into your TDS training, and you're kind of fascinated by Olaf Alexander Boo and the questions that he's trying to answer around peak performance. So, I mean, talk about that, like, because, you know, it's cool to see that infiltrating Ultra Trail as well, because, you know, when I think of Olaf and I think of the Norwegians and double thresholds, I'm thinking like, okay, triathlon scene or Jakob Ingebrigtsen or Northern Arizona University. So talk about how that's worked for you and why you're fascinated.
Yeah, I mean, I think this, I mean, I just love following their journey of like, what is like the maximum human performance, you know what I mean? Like, and I love following this journey of, you know, now we see Blumenfeld and Eden and we say, wow, these guys are these exceptional athletes, right? You know, they must be so talented and they must be, but like, actually, if you go really far back to when they were juniors, I mean, they were good, but they weren't exceptional like they are now. You know, and it's this idea, and I've really always appreciated this idea of this long-term view of, okay, we've spent, or these guys have spent 10 years training to be able to get to the point where now they can train to be able to achieve a new human peak performance, right? Because what we understand is like, okay, training is, you train, you get better, you train, you get better, right? And you keep improving. And in order to be able to do a certain level of, to have a certain level of capacity to handle training, I mean, you need to do years of training just to be able to get to the point to be able to train enough to be able to reach new peaks. You know what I mean? So they spent like 10 years training just to be good enough to now train how they train to be able to be the best in the world. Right. And I see that also, like, you know, Killian is another kind of example. When you look at, you know, from childhood, you know, at the age of like single digits, when they would go hiking in the mountains with his little backpack and his family, you know, like he was training without knowing he was training from when he was a child. And then like all this adds up over time. Like now we look at him, it's like people almost maybe take for granted that the only reason he can do what he's doing now is because he spent the previous 15 years doing all this work. And it's like, every little bit adds up and every little hour. And then like, you know, the amount of years where they're doing like over 1,000 hours of training, like all that just leads to the point where then you can do 1,200 hours of training, right? Which then leads to this next level that is kind of still unlocked, really. And I find it fascinating to see those guys now at this sort of precipice of like, doing things in sort of human physiology that have not been done before. Like they're essentially creating these beasts that are like astronomical, you know? But they've done this process, you know, and it's just been patience and patience and patience and just grinding and grinding. And okay, they sometimes you get this perfect storm of where you have these couple of athletes who are like willing to kind of dedicate their lives to it. And you've got this coach who's dedicating his life to this pursuit. And you end up with this perfect little storm and they're just doing this kind of outrageous stuff. But then from there always comes these trickle downs, you know, like I understand I'm not Blumenfeld and I understand I'm not Gustav Iden, but I understand what can it mean for me? How can I apply some of those principles and those mythologies? And also, how can you just apply the performance mindset? And to me, the performance mindset is like, how am I going to develop the best out of myself in everything I do? And I decide as to how far I take that. But like, you know, looking for performance in all the angles, physiology, you know, strategy, and just developing that mindset, you know? And then also I'm just personally just very curious. And so I kind of coach myself. So I try things and I'm really interested by them. You know, I've always sort of been like, you know, some people will say, you know, forget the double thresholds. And I've heard that from, you know, let's say coaches in the ultra world and stuff. Like, and I understand their perspective sometimes of like, okay, people just want to jump on the trends of what they're hearing or reading or, you know, without really necessarily the backup or the understanding of what that really means, right? Because, I mean, double thresholds and the way that they do it, I mean, what it, you know, it comes into this, I mean, a whole deep conversation about what is actually a threshold. Are you talking about a threshold for an hour, 40 minutes, 20 minutes, 5 minutes?
LT1, LT2, yeah.
And really, a lot of the Norwegian method is around intensity control, right? So most would say it's a sub-threshold effort, which means, you know, anywhere from 1.8 to 2.5 millimole of lactate in that area, depending a little bit, again, on what you're trying to achieve metabolically. But it's more about control versus like, oh, I'm going out and I'm running at my, you know, 5K pace every day. I mean, that's also not really what it is. But yeah, so I was doing quite a bit of double thresholds. And I was doing it also this winter as like, you know, a part, it is a block of training that I do as, and now I'm more into an endurance block coming into our, my first long race of the year. But I love to try it and I generally will try it for myself and see if it works for me. And if it does, I'll keep that in my program and maybe tune it and try things. And if not, I'm also happy to move on. I mean, I've just felt that for me, that worked quite well, that style of training. And so I'll keep doing it. And then other things also work really well that I incorporate different times of the season, depending on what we're doing, altitude, different things. So, but yeah, I'm just fascinated generally by training and how can you just get the most out of yourself, really? Like what is your personal peak, you know, because sometimes it is difficult because a lot of people, I think sometimes they put these preconceived limitations on themselves already. You know what I mean? Like I could never win UTMB. Well, why not? I mean, actually tell me why not? Is it because you don't have the time? You don't have, is it like, do you actually have a reason as to why you can't? Or is it just because you think, well, it's just too fast or they're too good or, you know, think about things, dissect them. Okay, what would be my limitations? What might not be? What are my strengths? And, you know, kind of be okay to dream a little bit. You know, you never know until you kind of try, is kind of my thing. I don't know if I can win UTMB or not. I have no idea. I mean, I would probably, like, the, you know, little guy on my shoulder says, oh, I don't know if you're fast enough to beat those guys. Like, a whole other ball game. But then there's the other guy who says, like, well, you know, why don't we try, you know? And I like to listen to that guy a little bit more. And, like, I mean, give it all I have. And then if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But you've learned something. You've grown as a person. You have new experiences. But, yeah, I'll say just don't cut yourself short straight away.
Well, let me ask you this. Has it been, over the course of your career, so cycling and ultra trail running, has it been easy to convince yourself or talk yourself into what's required for high performance and greatness?
Yeah. I mean, for me, I've always felt like, I always felt you can achieve anything you want. And like when I was young and I was thought, okay, I started riding a bike. I grew up in a very rural part of Canada, found cycling, mountain biking. And I thought, this is the greatest thing ever. You know what? I love this so much. I want to ride my bike every single day. How can I ride my bike every day? Well, I should probably just become a professional cyclist, and it's my job. So, And I kind of decided to do that as I would have decided to be a plumber or an architect or whatever. And I just told my parents, I'm going to become a professional cyclist. And they're like, okay. And then for me, from that point, it was just about, I didn't feel I had the doubt of I could do it or I couldn't do it. It was only about developing the logical steps of how do I get there, right? How can I become a professional cyclist? I said, okay, well, growing up in Canada where cycling was not very popular, I said, well, I should probably go to Belgium, because in my mind, Belgium was like this place where cycling is like the holy sport, right? And I was like, oh, I just need to go to Belgium because that's like the highest level, and I go there and I learn so much. So yeah, I took my last semester of school correspondence, and I just went to Belgium. Didn't know what I was going to do when I got there. Got there, somehow met some guys who ran a team, got on this team, started racing with these guys in Belgium. But it was just that kind of idea of you can achieve anything you want, right? Like, it wasn't easy by no means, like that step to get to becoming professional. You know, got my ass handed to me a lot of times. I was in a group of like national team athletes from Canada, and you know, first time we went to Europe, we got absolutely annihilated. And when we came back of the, I think 10 or 11, we were, pretty much all but myself stopped cycling, altogether, because they thought, well, I'm not going to make it, you know, it's too hard. And I kind of thought, well, I know I got my ass kicked, but now I understand, like now I understand this is the level that I need to be able to compete at. So now I just need to get that good. So I need to train, I need to train, I need to train. I know now, you know, we've got power meters, all that stuff. I know what numbers I need to hit if I don't want to get dropped on the climbs. And I can get there. Like, I was like surrounded by people. I'm like, these guys are all just human beings, just like myself. You know, they're training, I can train. I've never been here. I've never raced at this level. So yeah, how could I actually know what it was like? I've never done it. Now that I've done it, here's a logical sequence of events that I'm going to go through to try to get to the top. And then just go and do the work is really what it requires. And it's just kind of always come pretty natural to me. Like I understand that, like, you get your ass kicked sometimes, like, obviously. I mean, that's in you know, in everyday life as much. You start a new job. I mean, you get there the first day, they don't expect you to perform at your best because, I mean, it's your first day at the job. You know, you don't know any of the people you're working with. You don't understand anything. So I've always kind of taken it like, you know, you have an onboarding period, you learn a lot, and then you start to like develop your system to get to performance or get to the, where you want to go. But, you know, it takes a bit of, you know, getting it handed to you. It takes a bit of absorbing that and learning why, what, how. And of course it can be, you know, it can be a bit discouraging, but at the end of the day, you know, if you really love something, like nothing really worth pursuing, it's just going to come that easy, right? Like it takes time and it takes perseverance and it takes grinding to get there. You know, I think now we generally live a lot in a kind of society where we're just, it's too easy to be bombarded with only the best stuff. You know, we see the guys running on the ridges and we see the guys running to podiums and we see, you know, all the awesome things that are happening, but like it takes a lot of grinding in the background to get there, you know? And the grinding is kind of the part that I really quite enjoy. So, yeah.
And you seem to be at peace with the trade-offs too, because, you know, I've heard you talk about how you don't consider yourself to be the most gifted athlete, although I would dispute that. And that for you, it's been mostly hard work. And then you also have to be comfortable with a lot of the trade-offs. Like you have to have the ability to kind of go unbalanced from a lifestyle perspective to make it happen.
Yeah. I mean, I did say like, I don't feel I'm a truly gifted athlete by any means. Like it's never come really naturally. Like sometimes when I see guys running and stuff and run with them, like, you know, like even if they've not trained for a month and they go for a run, it's like, they're still going to smash me. And like, but again, I've figured out that it takes me longer and I do need to put in the time and it, but again, it's not that you can't get there. You just have to get there in your way. Right. But also, you know, it's quite funny because I've never, I love kind of living like an athlete. I kind of like that simplicity. And I don't find there, what a lot of people always considered sort of sacrifices, I've never really considered them sacrifices because I love the other thing so much, you know, like the sport is the thing that I really love. Like, in my day to day, my sport is the thing that I look forward to. It's a thing that I love to do. It's my happy place. And I prioritize that. You know, my day generally is set up around doing my sport and the thing that makes me the most happy. I prioritize that in my day. And then the rest of it, you know, commitments I have, work stuff, whatever, all comes secondary. Because life is short and you want to spend the most time doing the things that you love the most. It seems pretty logical. But in that sense, because I love that stuff so much, the other stuff is, I mean, I enjoy it less, you know, like I'm not really bothered if I don't get to go out for dinner or go for a party or do whatever. I mean, I enjoy those things, but like, if I don't do them, I would prefer not to and have like a better run the next day than to go and do it and then like feel like shit on my run. I would definitely choose the run or the sport. But I mean, that's just kind of a personal thing. Like I know guys who, or people who, you know, they are more social and, you know, it's kind of like, maybe it's a bit more of a struggle. Each person is obviously very individual and in what makes them kind of tick and what keeps them happy and balanced. And sometimes those trade-offs are worthwhile because, you know, I've seen a lot of athletes who overly dedicate, you know, that they sacrifice so much, where the sacrifice is so heavy for them that it leads to burnout, right? Which is quite common. Like I saw a lot in cycling because, you know, it's a very intense sport. And like, if you think about the Tour de France and these types of things and the things that you do sacrifice to get there, for some people, it's a lot of sacrifice. And then once they achieve that goal, you know, it becomes, you know, they really have to let their hair down after, or else it's, you know, they just totally burn out. And where other guys are naturally a little bit more balanced, you know, they're more likely to have a beer and a piece of cake, you know, every other day anyway, just to make sure that doesn't happen. So I've seen all strategies, but the balanced one is the one I've generally seen has the most success for people in the long term.
One more quick break to mention a new partner that I am really excited about, and that is Delta G Ketones. You've heard me talk about and support the use of ketones in performance settings like ultramarathons many times over the last couple of years. I've included exogenous ketones in my own training and racing during that stretch. And after taking roughly 6 months to do more research in this area of nutrition, particularly since last August, what turned me on to Delta G was that it's products allow individuals to achieve deep states of ketosis safely and immediately in both performance and recovery contexts. I will have much more to add about how and why I use Delta G in future episodes, but one of the biggest reasons I support this company is because it's got the only products out there that get individuals to achieve these beneficial levels of ketosis safely. So if you're interested in checking out their range of products, I encourage you to visit their website, deltagketones.com. And if you end up making a purchase, feel free to use code SINGLETRACK20 at checkout for 20% off your next order. With that, let's get back to the conversation with Christian Meyer. You know, we were talking earlier about how you have personally felt like you've experienced a second act in terms of reaching your peak, and you had thought you had already hit your peak, which made it even more fascinating. And you've been around, you know, some of the best endurance athletes ever in cycling and now in ultra trail. Have you ever met someone who you felt had really truly hit their potential, like not just a plateau, but a potential? And if so, like based on what you observed, was it a satisfying experience? Was it a depressing experience? Like to know that you've maxed out. If you've experienced that, talk about that.
Yeah. It is interesting. I've definitely seen probably more in the cycling side, seeing guys max out for sure. And to be honest, I think it's in cycling a lot of times from what I've seen, it's not healthy maxing out. And why? And I think that's because one of the criticisms of cycling for me is that it's a sport that demands a lot from athletes, right? Like it's very intensive in terms of, like we were saying before, you're on the road a lot, you're racing a lot, you're training a lot. It's a very insular bubble, right? Like it's same team, same riders, you know, you're on this, let's say, world circuit. And once you're out of that, you're out. So you go from this super intensive environment where it's like daily contact with friends, teammates, teams, you're at races, you know, mechanics, like to when your career is over and you sit on the outside of that, it's like from one day to the next, nobody's calling you anymore. You realize all your friends were cyclists who are still doing their thing. They're still in the bubble, right? And it becomes very quickly a very lonely and depressing place to be. And the sport never had a system for, I would say, almost reintegration into the modern world.
What's next?
Yeah, exactly. And so it was just this kind of like just spitting guys out, and then they just had to deal with it on their own. And it's not a very healthy way to go. And a lot of them, a lot of guys now might be a bit different, but like the guys that were kind of older who were stopping kind of when I was mid-career, a lot of those guys stopped and they didn't touch the bike. Like they stopped sports altogether, you know, and you go from like, you know, sport is something that gives you a lot of mental health and helps you a lot. It makes you feel good. I mean, there's a lot of things that come with sport that make you not just a healthier person physically, but mentally, and gives you clarity. And they would literally, from the day they retired, get home, the bike would stay in the bike bag in the garage and they wouldn't touch a bike for 2 years, 3 years. So it's like, they just totally left and just left that all behind. And it became like, you could see them really struggling. And now it's getting a bit better. You see more people like, you know, the younger generation of my age, and we're more, I think, generally healthy people in general. Like people now exercise more, enjoy more sport. They understand how it can help you with mental health. And so sport is more ingrained in, and cycling, as much as it's gone to that marginal gains and all that crazy stuff, I think it's become kind of a healthier sport once you leave professional cycling. So that's quite good. But also, like, you know, from personal experience, you know, in cycling, obviously, I kind of stopped. And cycling to me is a little bit different because it wasn't about the competitive aspect of cycling. Like it wasn't about the racing. I just loved riding my bike and training and like being in that team environment and working. And so I didn't really struggle to leave the racing. And then having this sort of entering this new sport and having this moment of like, oh, wow, this is really cool. Like I'm doing another sport and now I'm trying to find out, you know, what is my peak in this sport, you know? Like you sort of mentioned before, I thought, oh, maybe high performance sport was kind of over for me, you know, like really being at that pointy end. And now you're like, oh, wow, I found this other sport where I can do that again. Obviously, that sport works really well because ultra distance works, you know, it comes a bit with age, right? So, you know, I'm obviously not going to be, you know, golden trail athlete now and racing with Remy and these young guys. Not that that was ever my forte anyway, but you sort of see that, wow, this is a sport that, you know, with age and that certain level of endurance and that kind of speed and rhythm that it is, this is something that actually is, I can still develop a bit of a peak in this sport. Like I probably won't, like I know I wouldn't go back to cycling and reach the same peak as I did in my like late 20s, early 30s, but I can reach a new peak in this new sport, which is super cool. But also last year, like after TDS, like I had a massive, massive downer, which was new to me because I'd never had that in cycling. Also because I never, probably on the scale of, you know, what that result means in cycling, I probably never achieved something as cool, as big. And after that, I, you know, obviously it was very exciting in the time and you've got like a week of kind of like real euphoria or a couple of weeks. But after that was like a good couple of months where I was really like low and kind of down, and you know, that sort of came with like, wow, I did like, what am I going to do now? Is this like the best thing that maybe I'll ever achieve in running? And, you know, it's like, yeah, this just moment of questioning and uncertainty and kind of maybe a little scared that that's kind of it. And like, you know, what do I do now? But it was pretty rough. Like it was a good couple of months where I was kind of down and out, to be honest, which I think comes from having such an exceptional high, if you talk about balance, you know, you have to have the low on the other eye, on the other side, maybe.
It also makes me wonder if you spent the majority of your endurance career having to be selfless by nature, to operate in anonymity by nature, because you're a domestique, right? Like your job is to deliver the stars to the finish line. And then for the first time in your career, you delivered yourself to the finish line and you got to celebrate. Like, that is such a 180. It totally makes sense to me why you would, you know, have a low and question like identity and stuff like that after TDS. Like, it makes total sense to me.
Yeah. I mean, it does. And like, I kind of understood it was happening and I was like, okay. I also understood that it would pass, you know, and that, like, I think, you know, having read, I think it's something that's can be, normal when you try, you know, when you achieve like a really big goal, you know, I think some athletes have that with like Olympic Games and things like that, where it's like a really big buildup. And then, you know, when you achieve it, it's kind of like, you know, sometimes it's almost better getting second place because it's just that enough that you know, keep grinding. But, you know, you kind of recalibrate and then, you know, set your goals or set your sights on the next goals and work towards that.
I want to come back to something you said earlier. I know that you love training methodology. You love digging into the numbers. You love kind of checking out what's avant-garde when it comes to how to be better as an athlete. You know, self-coaching, like you're self-coached. A lot of the stars in our sport are still self-coached. This is something we haven't released the episode yet, but we just talked with Dirk Friel from Training Peaks sort of about this phenomenon, because he also was pretty steeped in the cycling world, but now his company services, you know, all endurance sports. I guess I'm wondering how, like, as our sport professionalizes and becomes more data-driven and marginal gains focused, how much longer can an athlete like yourself hang on to the job of being self-coached? At some point, do you have to outsource that? Or from your experience in cycling, were there athletes that made it work?
I would say in cycling, nobody that I really knew was self-coached. Well, for a while, the Yates brothers, in the early days of Orca, they kind of self-coached themselves, which is awesome. But yeah, I don't know many now that would be self-coached cyclists at all. Definitely not. I think that kind of comes, there is still, I mean, when I had a coach cycling, I mean, it was very much a two-way conversation. Like, they were very open to input, right? And as a cyclist, at a certain point, you understand what works really well for you. And you kind of give input and they might write the program and block it out for you and kind of oversee the full season, right? And also we talk about, it's not always about a full season. It's about multiple seasons, right? Like, you know, there's things like riders will, maybe classics riders will like to do the Vuelta in August, September, because doing that big load into the off season then sets you up already maybe a little bit better for the spring classics the next year. So it's like, you know, we're thinking a lot more than just the next couple of races. Like in cycling, especially in really professional teams, we're looking at, or they are looking at, multiple seasons and how stacking races and stacking load will then lead to potentially a future result at a Grand Tour or something like that. So I think that is where that coaching structure really helps bring that all together. Obviously, there's a lot of really great sports physiologists and a lot of, you know, the things that I'm picking up on are coming from there, right? So those are the people that are developing these methodologies. And then also within the team, in the cycling, there's a much more, the team aspect and sort of the team is informed on the day-to-day of athletes' trainings, right? So at any point, the team could log into your, I mean, we were using Training Peaks, most do. Go log into your Training Peaks and see your training, see what you've been up to, which might guide them into, you know, we have a race, a guy just got injured, we need to bring somebody else in. Who's in the right position to be able to fill that slot, right? Based on their training in the past couple of weeks or a month or whatever. So there's a lot of more information that gets recorded, tracked for a lot of reasons other than just, you know, you need to perform for this race next week. So it's a bit more complex, I think, on that scale. Where I think on the running side, on the ultra running side, probably even more specifically, you don't race as much. Obviously, you kind of can't. I mean, it's almost more towards that Ironman. And I feel like you would probably, there are definitely Ironman athletes who are some of the best in the world who are training themselves. Like I know a couple of triathletes in Girona who race professionally, who train themselves. Yeah. Probably because it's a bit easier to structure out blocks of training because you have big blocks to train, and it's not sort of like continually intercepted with other races and like sort of craziness. And you have these blocks of focus and you have these specific races that allow it to be kind of a bit simpler to manage and plan all that. But I think in ultra, yeah, I think it's a little bit easier to train yourself. And I think a lot of athletes can do that and be quite successful at it. Also sort of thinking like, you know, I follow Dan Bingham and some others who are also self-coached and who are obviously very into training. But also when you look at the demands of ultra racing and stuff, like cycling is a pretty unique sport in the fact that like everybody is an endurance athlete, right? But you still need to train so many different aspects because like sprinters, okay, we see them as, okay, they sprint the last 200 meters. They're super fast twitch guys, et cetera, et cetera. But they still need to ride the 200 kilometers before the sprint. Yep. You know, they're not sprint athletes. They're endurance athletes who can sprint. You know what I mean? Or, you know, even as a climber, you know, it's all about watts per kilo in the climb. But you still need to be able to ride in the crosswind. So you still need to develop short bursts of high power. Like, it's such a different athlete that has to do a very robust style of training that includes, you have to be really good at probably one thing and then very good at a bunch of other things, right? Whereas, you know, in ultra running, I mean, it's all about developing, well, obviously your aerobic system so you can run as fast as possible for the extended amount of time.
Build a massive engine, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, avoiding, you know, durability, avoiding breakdown towards the end of the race. It's relatively simple systems that you need to try to coach and develop. And it definitely has its complexities, but, you know, we're not, you know, within an ultra, we're not doing segments of a VK and then like, you know, like 5K flat race and then, you know, 10,000 meters of climbing. I mean, you can kind of focus on just having to do the one thing, which is quite nice. But no, I think there's still room for in running that people can definitely self-coach a bit more.
One other thing that I want to talk about before we close up is that outside of running, you're extremely active in the business community. You've got the apparel brand Chance. You've got the running store Overland. You're roasting beans at La Fabrica. And maybe just to start, which one is most interesting to you? Of those three, where are you most interested right now?
I love coffee. Yeah, that's true. Those were our first businesses, or the coffee ones. My wife runs those on the day-to-day, the cafes. Overland, I'm really loving Overland. What I'm really loving about Overland is the community. We have an amazing community. And just seeing these sort of groups of runners come together. And last weekend was the Barcelona Marathon. And we had a very dedicated group of the community who were racing the marathon. And it was just amazing because, you know, we have 3 training runs per week that we run out of the shop. And they were doing, like, that group was doing everything, the track sessions, the doubles. They were like just hammering it. And to see them all have these like exceptional races is so cool. And how much, you know, that community supports each other and fosters each other and pushes each other to go and do like some really amazing things is super cool. And I just love sharing my time with like-minded people who enjoy the same things. Like, that's kind of what community is. And then Chance on the one side is really interesting at the moment, because of where running is going right now, I think is super interesting. It's kind of where cycling was going maybe the last 8 to 10 years, where we're starting to see cool brands doing cool things. You know, I mean, I think I see some Nordas on the back wall there. Yeah. You know, things are happening that are interesting, you know, and, you know, you're starting to see this shift in, you know, like Salomon sports style, you know, it's become such a cool thing. And, you know, you're seeing, you know, Rihanna wear them at the Super Bowl. Like, things are happening and running where it's kind of like, man, things are getting cool here. And we want to be a part of that. And that's kind of where Chance is really cool. So we're kind of focusing on this next sort of drop that's coming in this spring and throughout the summer, about creating some really cool products. And it's pretty cool because at the end of the day, kind of what happens and what happens through most of these businesses is that they tend to be an outlet for things that are happening in my mind and kind of just in my ecosystem. And it's really about when we think of going back to thinking about something like UTMB and marginal gains, or, you know, gains in general, is how are you potentially developing the best possible outfit for racing UTMB, right? Like, what does that mean? What does that look like? And can we make that,
right? And Chance could solve that. Chance would work towards that end.
Exactly. So that's kind of what we're trying to do. There'll be some things we're trying to do at UTMB that we'll release for UTMB. Well, that hopefully I'll be racing in a UTMB that I think will be really unique and kind of exceptional products to bring just that last bit of performance. I mean, generally we would always think cycling or running clothing is relatively basic, shorts and shirt. But, you know, which is great. And for most people is totally fine. But there is that little itch of like, well, what would the very best stuff look like? You know, like maybe the t-shirt will cost a few $100. I don't know, but would it make a difference? And how can we kind of manage that whole piece? So yeah, I really love the product side and developing products and things like that, and testing them and whatnot. So yeah, that's pretty exciting at the moment.
I know your wife is heavily involved in the operation for the coffee business, but with Chance and Overland, do you build a team around you to help you manage the business? Is it mostly just you? How does that work?
No, so Chance, I do it with a co-founder.
Okay.
Tom Austin, we set that up a couple of years ago. And then overland, I just have a really great manager. Alesh, he's actually been working within our organization in other businesses, because we used to have a cycling business also. So he's actually been in the organization probably for like 6-7 years.
Wow.
And he's an amazing runner. He ran just over 2:30 in the Barcelona Marathon. And so he runs overland, and luckily for me, you know, I can kind of work with him and give input and do things, and he's definitely executing. And then, yeah, in Chance, Tom and I kind of share the responsibilities. He's more on the marketing sales side. I'm doing a bit more of the product stuff. And I have someone who's helping me a little bit with the product side, just to manage the day-to-day. Cause it's quite a lot with the factories and stuff like that. So yeah, I mean, it's all about people. It's all about having the right people help you.
This is kind of philosophical, but when I think about your situation, I'm impressed, because I think we're in this era where, you know, people will resort to killing time on their phone. They'll consume way more than they create. And they'll say to themselves and people around them that they're super busy, when a lot of free time has kind of been sucked up by entertainment. And I feel like, and again, I don't know you too well, but just from what I can observe, you seem to make most minutes of each day count, and you kind of find ways to be efficient. Like you're a pro athlete, but you know, when that part of your life is done for the day, you have these other things to go to, and you operate there efficiently. It's pretty cool. I think it's a good inspiration for people out there.
I'm glad you think that, because I'm highly unorganized. yeah, I mean, I think there's probably need to give more credit to the people around me, because I think from the outside, it probably looks like I do a lot more than I do. It's busy, but you know, like I said, I very much prioritize, maybe a little selfishly, being an athlete, and then work the rest around that. Mm. But also it's things that I enjoy to do. I mean, sometimes, yes, of course, sometimes it's a bit, there's heavier workloads than others. But other times I go to Madeira for a week and essentially just run and train. So, I find it feels pretty balanced. Yeah. But you know, I'm not prone to, I mean, I'm definitely not a superstar. I'm prone to losing time on ridiculous things here and there, but, yeah, it's about having the good team and just allowing me, I mean, the team essentially what they allow me to do, what I'm best at, which is more of the creative side and a little bit the visionary side and things like that. And they kind of execute really well, that idea and that vision without needing a whole lot of supervision, which is really good and kind of allows that, that ecosystem to grow a little bit. I mean, sometimes I feel bad for my wife, because I have these ideas, we should do this, and she's like, okay, but you know, I love creating things, but then she ends up having to deal with the aftermath, which is running the things. yeah, we make a good team.
Before we go, I know we're catching you just after one of those island training camps. What does this year look like for you racing wise?
Yeah, so actually next week we go another training camp. So we have a Solomon team training camp in, I think we're going to Corsica. So that's next week, which will be super exciting, because it'll be the first time I get to spend some time with the team and meet everybody and do stuff. I mean, I know one or two of the athletes. Caitlin Fielders lived in Girona.
Yep.
I've been training with her for a couple of years already. So, but the rest of the team will be super fun to meet. And then from there, the plan is Snowdonia, So Ultra Trail Snowdonia, 100K, which I'm quite looking forward to. I think it looks brutal, which is good. And then from there, UTMB is the, I guess, kind of the big one for the summer. And building up towards there, I mean, I have another option at Verbier early July, or maybe I'll try to find something end of June in that period again, just to do another solid hit out. But those would be the main races for the year.
Cool. Well, we'll make sure to link to Overland and Chance and La Fabrica and the Substack and all your social in the show notes. But this has been an awesome conversation, Christian. Really appreciate your time. Any final thoughts or calls to action that you want to leave listeners and viewers with before we go?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm always a big guy for following your dreams, and you know, you never know what can happen. I mean, be open, listening. You know, you definitely, some points in your life, you're going to lose things that you think meant everything, but then at the end, you're going to gain something potentially much bigger on the other side. So yeah, you got to ride the waves and take what life brings you. But yeah.